This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. No issue in American politics is more contested than gun rights. Believers in strong Second Amendment rights typically argue that little or no restriction should be placed on people's abilities to buy, own, and carry weapons, while critics often push for banning of whole classes of weapons, strict rules about who is allowed to buy guns and how many, and limiting where guns can be carried and whether they can be loaded. But for all the heat generated by talk about guns, very few of us know very little about the history of guns in America. My guest today is the journalist David Harsanyi, and he seeks to remedy that in his latest book, First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun. It's a well-documented deep look at the role guns have played in our country's history even before we became a country. David Harsanyi is a senior editor at The Federalist. He's a syndicated columnist. He's a contributor to Reason, and he's also the author of several previous books, including The People Have Spoken and They Are Wrong, The Case Against Democracy, and Nanny State, How Food Fascists, Teetotaling Do-Gooders, Priggish Moralists, and Other Boneheaded Bureaucrats Are Turning America into a Nation of Children. David, thanks for talking to Reason.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So let's start with the kind of elevator pitch about the book. At one point you write, because of, and I'm quoting from you, because of the divisive political realities of the age, we often hear the term gun culture being thrown around as invective. Gun culture, you write, is no less a part of American life than religious culture or speech culture. As our history unambiguously illustrates, gun culture is inextricably linked to American culture. One cannot exist without the other. What are you getting at there?
Well, I grew up in an area where when I was a kid, no one had guns other than criminals in New York, basically. So I was always sort of interested in what was unique about American life and the gun and why certain people really treated it, sort of idealized guns and treated it that, you know, in a romantic sort of way almost.
And you grew up in what, like Queens, New York?
Yeah, I grew up in Queens and then Long Island. So, yeah. It was somewhat working class, but still it wasn't, I don't know anyone who went hunting or anyone who had, you know, guns in their home or anyone who gave a gun. Like growing up, I mean, in my professional life, I've met a lot of people from middle America, and they're like, you know, my dad gave me a shotgun when I was 12 or something. That would have been horrifying.
And it's fascinating because I'm also from a similar area, the New York area, of where guns were, I mean, you would see them on TV shows. You would read about them in the newspaper because somebody pulls a gun, but you would never go over to a house. Nobody had gun racks. Nobody had rifles. Nobody had anything.
I didn't shoot my first gun until I was in my 30s. So, but I was always sort of a big Second Amendment proponent whenever, you know, at the point I started thinking about things like that. And it was very ideological for me. And because of the debate that is very partisan and very ideological, I figured it would be interesting to tell the story of gun culture outside of that in a way. And it's not to say I don't talk about the philosophical underpinnings of the Second Amendment, but guns have been embedded in American life from the beginning as a tool of survival, as a way of commerce. I mean, when you talk about the first industrial revolution, you're talking about gun makers, and for hobbyists. So it's been part of America in numerous ways for a long time. And I think without understanding that history, you can't really understand the debate today.
Talk about the early part. I mean, the book is set up into different sections that are roughly historical, large historical units. But talk about the colonial experience with guns that led into the American Revolution. And obviously, you know, Reason supports we don't have any positions everybody holds, but everybody at Reason believes in strong Second Amendment rights. And one of the standard arguments is that if you have guns, you it's a hedge against tyranny. How did that play out in the American Revolution?
Well, you know, I'm not sure people understand that the rights of self-defense and owning a firearm, but other weapons as well, goes back farther in British sort of common law and law than the right, certainly freedom of religion and freedom of speech. It's one of the oldest rights that you have in liberalism, you know, small liberalism. So the Americans came over with that. They came over with a tradition of militias. But more than that, the place that they were geographically and physically, the things they had to deal with. For instance, when the pilgrims first landed, within a day, arrows were falling on them. They had to defend themselves. They had to survive by hunting. All those things made guns indispensable, not to mention they had to worry about the French, the Spanish, and others. It made it indispensable in a way that Europeans were sort of settled and protected by the state, didn't have to worry about. The state was thousands of miles away, quite often couldn't protect you. And that tradition actually kept going on till the 50s, where Americans were moving west constantly and sort of on their own in a way. So I think those deep traditions have a lot to do with guns as well. I don't think those two can be separated.
Yeah, and it was interesting. At one point, you write about how it's kind of telling that after the American Revolution and after the Patriots, the Loyalists, the Americans win, right? The rebels. I'm trying to remember who all these people are. But you say that one thing that's interesting is that there wasn't any part of the country, any government agency that said, okay, the war's over, now give us back your guns.
Right. I mean, there's this sort of revisionist history about how the guns weren't that prevalent, but that it was a collective right. But militias don't exist without individuals who have guns. No one asked the Minutemen to hand back their weapons and muskets after they were shooting at the British. And at Lexington and Concord, the Americans, who fought a far, far larger, better trained force, and many died there, were fighting to protect a cache of weapons. They were, you know, and the powder alarm, which happened right before the Revolution, and almost, you know, fighting almost broke out then, they were protecting gunpowder, which was very difficult to come by at the time. So all those things were driven by weapons. And quite often I read a lot of history and a lot of American history. Sometimes they don't even mention guns in the book, you know, and you're like, that is one of the main reasons. That's why I call it first freedom. If you don't have that freedom, obviously the other ones can be taken away.
Yeah, even though it's typical. I mean, normally we think about the First Amendment or the first, you know, First Amendment rights and the gun rights or the Second Amendment. You mentioned briefly that the early Industrial Revolution, or a lot of the kind of entrepreneurs and tinkerers and ultimately major industrialists in America were gun makers. Talk about people like Colt, Smith & Wesson, Winchester. It's funny. These are names that, you know, the people behind them have kind of faded because we just take them as a, I guess like Ford or Chrysler. We don't really think about the guys behind that anymore.
Well, some of them were the first great capitalists, you know, that existed in this country. I mean, they're very American characters, autodidacts who sort of were tinkering, as you said, and came up with amazing ideas. Now, just to step back and view history more broadly, you went from shooting a musket maybe twice in a minute to early 1900s shooting hundreds of rounds per minute in World War I, just massacring people in a way. And fortunately or not, Americans were a big part of that evolution. And Sam Colt, for instance, was just one of the most amazing American characters. He changed the way we do things in many different areas. For instance, he was one of the first people to use interchangeable parts way before Ford did it, which could make a gun cheaper so a normal man could just buy one or more than one. He used the press to sell it. He had celebrity endorsements. He created the mythology of the West in many ways, or started to. And he was just an amazing character. He was the first American sort of industrialist to go to Europe and open a factory rather than them coming here. So he did many amazing things. I think he deserves a new big biography himself. But others, Smith and Wesson and all these other people that you mentioned, Winchester, for instance, wasn't an engineer. He was a shirt maker, and he decided that guns were a better money maker for him, and they were. So there were a lot of guys like that who just went to Connecticut mostly, but elsewhere, who really were great engineers and
was
self-taught.
Was the concentration of people in Connecticut, was it just that obviously New England and the Mid-Atlantic region were the first, you know, heavily populated, and they were early to industrialize because, you know, I guess they had a hydroelectric power and stuff. But was there something specific about Connecticut, or is it just kind of like one company starts there and then, you know, people get trained by it or leave it or you know, like attracts like?
I think it's a lot of that. But also not far away in Massachusetts, in Springfield, was where the first American armory was. And a lot of the engineers who worked there would later leave and start their own companies. It reminds me in many ways of like Silicon Valley right now, where you had campuses like the Colt factory was a campus. People lived on it. They provided entertainment. Their life sort of revolved around that campus. So they were very similar in many ways.
You know, at this point in the 19th century, what is there a mythology around the gun? And if so, you know, what was it?
There is. I think we mythologized the 19th century, in many ways, the West, you know, with all the violence we see in movies, which really didn't exist. Most people had guns, so people were far more, they were, you don't just pull a gun when everyone has a gun, right? You're going to be a little more careful. So I'd like Dodge City, I think, for the time of the gunslinger, I think there was one murder per year on average, something right. like that. But other things as well, the Kentucky rifle, which was one of the great early innovations in guns, was not used in the hardly used in the Revolution yet. We, you know, later on it was sort of romanticized as being a big part of it. So, you know, there's that kind of thing. But when you read I went back and read a lot of old books from the 1800s, and the way people romanticized guns was even a little bit, you know, shocking to me. I mean, it was a big part of their lives. When you look at Daniel Boone, for instance, right. he's always standing there with his Kentucky rifle, things like that.
Well, yeah, obviously, if you're exploring the continent or if you're moving around on the front lines of stuff, you talk a little bit about Lewis and Clark and what was the role of weaponry in their expedition?
Well, obviously, for hunting, it was important. They were some of the first, at least English-speaking people, to run across herds of buffalo, which they couldn't believe what they were seeing, you know, 30-mile-long herds, things like that. But interestingly, they brought with them a different kind of gun. It was an air gun, which could shoot almost like fully automatic weapon, and mostly it was used to impress the Indians that they met along the way, not really to use in any sort of way, you know, any sort of warlike way or for violence. So for the most part, their guns, and they had other sort of really almost cannon guns, it's hard to explain, that were sort of makeshift, but they used them mostly to impress the people around them, not as a deterrent, right? And that's, big guns are often a deterrent.
So it's
right?
a Dirty Harry, but set in the 19th century.
Exactly.
But then am I remembering correctly when you say that, but when Lewis and Clark kind of came back and they were going through, I guess, St. Louis or something like that, they basically unloaded all of their weapons for like $400 and nobody knows what happened to them.
No, they were sold at auction and then they sort of disappeared. Now, sometimes we find old guns, like the NRA Museum in Virginia, not far uh-huh. from here, it's a really cool museum, tons of guns that they have, the Mayflower gun. And, you know, I'm a little skeptical that that gun was actually right. in the Mayflower, but it is beautiful.
Who was that? Was owned by like Miles Standish or somebody?
No,
like that?
This one was owned by just a person on the, you know, just okay. a regular person on the boat. And yeah. It was a wheel lock mechanism, really intricate, mm-hmm. beautiful. But again, you know, I'm a little skeptical.
The couple of people I want to ask you about, because they are gun heroes, but one was Custer. And obviously not a hero, but we have this image of him at Little Bighorn and his men being, you know, surrounded and then taken down in a hail of arrows. But that isn't quite right, right?
No, I mean, archaeologists went back and now they have found all kinds of guns of the time. And it was sort of a great period for innovation, and the Indians literally, I think, outgunned him, not out-arrowed him. Now, don't get me wrong, for many years, arrows were better than guns in certain kinds of fighting. They were more precise. The early Americans could shoot a musket maybe 50 yards and not for much aim. That's why the Kentucky rifle was so interesting. Arrows could be better. And Indians were great, great with guns, and right away they took to them in the 1600s, and it changed their lives, the way they hunted, the violence sort of their, you know, tribal warfare. But the problem for them was obviously they couldn't build them and they couldn't make ammunition. So that was always their problem. But if they could have done that, maybe things turn out a little differently.
Talk about Wild Bill Hickok, because he's kind of the first poster boy of a quick draw guy. Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and he's been mythologized quite a bit, but he was a real person and he was a murderer. You know, I mean, there are a lot of those gunfighters that we now sort of celebrate were basically just psychopaths. You know, many of them were just, Billy the Kid was just a murderer, you know, and it wasn't as if they met at, you know, on the street in town and faced off and dueled each other. He would just shoot people in the back or whatever it was, you know, so we've made the gunfighter sort of a hero or anti-hero or whatever that they aren't. But As for Hickok, he was an amazing character who sort of was the template for what other gunfighters would want to be in the future, how he looks, long hair, all of that. And he became famous because a writer for Harper's went out west and was told stories about this guy who was a really quick draw, you know, and had a famous duel with a guy named, I think it was Dave Tutt, who was a Confederate soldier. And that story sort of blew up the whole, you know, the storytelling of the West. It created the whole template that we even use now in movies. And you had all the penny presses and all the sort of books that were sold. Millions of them were sold. Were put on.
What need do you think that was filling? What itch was that scratching people back east?
Well, I think that America has such a short history that they don't have the sort of mythology that others have, and that that they were probably reaching back for their own time when people were so individualistic. It's very important in American lore to be individualistic, take care of yourself, defend yourself. That probably was something that excited them in simply because it was purely American and something they could celebrate, I guess, about America.
And that feeds into the rise of Buffalo Bill Cody and Annie Oakley, who had a show, right? I mean, it was basically like the Prairie Home Companion, but with... You might throw in Sitting Bull and a bunch of Indians and cowboys doing a scene inside. Where was that the most popular, and how did that flesh out this kind of mythic West that kind of was still there but had already faded and then had never really existed in the first place?
Well, once you had the story, once the West became popular in the East, people were looking for heroes, right? So Buffalo Bill got his name because he could kill, literally these people were killing thousands of buffaloes, like, you know, within a few months' time, because buffalo wouldn't run away. You could literally shoot, I keep saying literally, but you could shoot them in the head and walk away and then shoot the next one. So he was doing that for the railroads, which were moving west. And someone sort of found him as a hero when he went to Chicago, and he wrote a play with a few others in about 2-3 hours, and they put it on. And from all contemporary accounts, it was terrible, but people loved it, and it became a huge hit. And he decided, because he was a smart man, though not educated, that he could form his own show, and he did. And he brought all the sort of heroes of the West that he can find, sharpshooters, you know, people who could lasso and things like that, and famous Indian chiefs, even people who had fought against each other. Sort of, it reminds me of the Roman Colosseum in a way, where the Romans would like sort of set up a fake lake and have, you know, naval battles and things like that. And then he found Annie Oakley, who was really an amazing, amazing woman who is not that mythologized. She was just an amazing shot. She would do all kinds of incredible things. And it wasn't just famous in the East. They went to Europe quite often. Buffalo Bill spent half the year touring and half the year in his ranch in Wyoming.
And I guess the Europeans also then were also fetishizing America as it was, the American West was this kind of outer space exploration deal or something.
Absolutely. One of the first movies was of Annie ever made was of Annie Oakley shooting. So she was just a huge, hugely famous person.
She did get her own Broadway musical eventually. So
she died in Maryland with her husband, who was also a sharpshooter, and they were married for a very long time.
They died peacefully, right? They weren't drawing on each other.
Well, Annie Oakley wrote a letter, I think it was to McKinley or whoever was present during the Spanish-American War, that she could get some women who were great, because she wasn't the only Annie Oakley. You know, there were others like her, and that they could go over there and do some sniping.
How did the increase in shooting power, stopping power of guns, and you alluded earlier to machine guns by World War One, you know, the mechanics of the ability of guns to do mass violence, did that take any of the shine off of the gun as an object in American life?
I think to a certain extent, yes, because when you think about the Gatling gun, it was the first sort of, it was a cranked machine gun. It was hard to use. In movies, you see them used in the Civil War all the time. They were hardly ever used because they were very hard to aim and move around. You could outflank it.
But there's always that iconic scene of where, you know, regular Joe soldiers are walking by and somebody comes up and takes a tarp off it and then mows them down. Right.
Yeah. Like the outlaw Josie Wales, you know, things like that. Very rarely used, though. The only time it was used was when a soldier himself bought it for his troops, meaning a colonel or something bought one and brought it in. It was, you know, so, but it changed the way I think people thought about guns. And soon you had a Maxim gun, which was a recoil powered automatic gun. And then John Browning and others invented the gas-powered gun, which essentially you could shoot as much as you wanted, you know, and that's why you have trench warfare in World War One. So the big change from the Civil War to World War One is amazing. And I think that Americans, especially then, not to jump too far ahead, but in the 1930s when you had these criminals gallivanting around the countryside with fully automatic Tommy guns and actually big, heavy machine guns, it changed the way Americans thought about it, and that's when you first get the gun control stuff.
Yeah, I wanted to go to that. Talk about the murder that happened in New York in 1911 that kind of started modern gun control. And there had been, you mentioned in the book, in the 19th century, there were various kind of local attempts to regulate guns in all sorts of different ways. And blacks at various points had been disarmed, just as particularly in the South. But it's really, it's kind of fascinating to think about what we call gun control is really a 20th century phenomenon. But talk about this murder in New York that kind of got that ball rolling.
Right. So, as you mentioned, there were some gun control laws, but never, ever did a person that I know of in history, in American history, is a person required to go to the state and ask permission to own a gun? Sometimes you have to hand in your gun because you're in a red light district or whatever, and you agree to that, but you don't have to go there, obviously, that sort of thing. But in New York, there was a murder by, basically, it seems like it was an insane person who shot a playwright in broad daylight on the street and then tried to shoot himself. And I believe he didn't die, but maybe he died later. So there was an autopsy done, and the person who saw this autopsy was horrified by the results and sort of petitioned government to do something about it. And we started passing laws in New York City proper where you had to have a license to carry a gun. That's the first time you have a concealed carry permit, mm-hmm. basically. Mostly, though, it was used because there was sort of gang warfare going on, Catholics and that sort of thing. And basically it was, the Irish against, others, and was used for that sort of thing within politics. And it wasn't enforced very strongly because people, as we see through records of criminality, had guns, as you know, there were tons of guns around that weren't registered. But that was the first time that people asked the state. People were asked to go to the state and ask permission to have a handgun, and it was sort of a turning point.
And then you talk about how in the 20s and 30s, criminality or gun violence seemed to it's not necessarily clear that it was that common, but it was certainly very visible and very public. And you start to get more, and organized crime also, I guess, comes, for the first time.
Prohibition really created this criminality, and the criminality brought more violence and death and certainly homicides with guns.
And then that leads to, among other things, the National Firearms Act. What is the role of that in kind of 20th century gun culture?
Well, so you had all these criminals running around with guns, and it was scary, but it was basically happening in a few urban areas. Elsewhere, there was not any sort of spike in gun crimes. Chicago was one place, and somewhat in New York and elsewhere. And even then, the per capita gun homicide rate was still lower than it is in Chicago today. You know what I'm saying? So it was, but movies, you had all these movies sort of celebrating these, James Cagney, things like that, where they're shooting Tommy guns without any sort of recoil. They're just, mowing people down. It's all fiction, right? Tommy guns were rarely used in criminal acts because they were super expensive to buy, and they were also not effective for criminals. They didn't want to kill a bunch of people. They wanted to kill one person usually at a time.
Criminals are very focused,
though. Yes, they're good at their jobs and they do what they need to do. So obviously, but they were used and it was scary to people. So you had, because of this, you had the federal government, which was, when FDR came in, everything was sort of central. He was focused on centralizing government in many ways. So they started passing laws where you weren't allowed to carry certain types of guns. And if you had a machine gun, fully automatic machine gun rather than just a semi-automatic, you had to pay. You had to sort of register or pay money to have one. And that sort of laid the groundwork for the first time for the federal government to get involved in gun control. And there were two separate bills, and then they were purposely challenged in court so that FDR's Supreme Court could say it was all kosher. And that has sort of laid the groundwork not only for gun control, but for the collectivist sort of revisionism of American gun ownership and things like that. That's when the debate first started. But it was crystallized, I think, later in the 70s.
And because what in the post-war era crime, you know, crime does start to rise pretty significantly.
Well, first it falls, but it rises by the 70s.
And then also a number of high-profile assassinations, whether it's JFK or RFK or Martin Luther King. How did that, how did that kind of activity, simultaneously, it seems you have a couple of things going on. One is that romance of the gun of, you know, Gary Cooper in High Noon, who is, you know, he's a peaceful man or whatever, but he'll do what he has to do, starts to go out the window, and you get this idea of criminality. And then you also have, in a fascinating way, in the 60s, and I think the Black Panthers did this most spectacularly, where they started using the gun as a way of menacing white America. And there's the famous sequence where they actually, because of a tick in California's laws, you could actually carry guns openly as long as you weren't concealing them. And then that leads to hysteria.
Few people made better arguments for the Second Amendment than the Black Panthers. That's true. And they had the black history with the gun is, and, you know, after the Civil War, many civil rights activists of the time were very, very pro-gun. And the Black Panthers actually made a very, very good and strong argument for the Second Amendment as a means of protecting oneself. Occasionally they killed a cop or whatever, but, you know, that's separate from their argument. It's very interesting. So I think that after the war, you had a ton of men coming home. Many of them had weapons, and crime did not go up. There was a huge boom in hunting and sports and things like that with a gun, but not much crime. I forgot what the polls are exactly, but there was a poll where, do you feel safe in your home? And it was like 90% of people did in America. By 1965, 66, that plummets. And from mid-60s to the 90s, actually, this is an era of crime, basically, and early 90s. That's when the gun debate changed. You had people, probably half urban people mostly, saying we have to take guns away from people because this is crazy what's going on. I'm getting mugged. And then you have half people saying I need a gun to protect myself from these crazy people. So that's where the divide happens. That basically is what we're still debating, I think. And that's when cities, but also in 68, some federal laws start to really push gun control. And that's why people in D.C. couldn't. That's why Heller happened later and so forth. So there was a lot of criminality, much more than in the 30s. And that really changed the way things happened. In fact, in 1977, that's when the NRA had its famous conference where they had to decide if they're going to move to Colorado and become sort of a sportsman's group or they were going to become a political group. And if it wasn't the NRA, someone else would have done it. But they made obviously the choice to stay in D.C.
Talk about Ronald Reagan, because he's kind of a fascinating character. Obviously, he's a very fascinating character for all sorts of reasons. And in the context of debates about the Second Amendment and gun culture and whatnot, because he's a strong supporter. You know, he played Western heroes. He was like a version of Gary Cooper at various parts. But it's also true he was shot. And he ended up endorsing kind of laws now that, you know, people who are Second Amendment fanatics are go bananas over, like gun waiting periods, getting rid of certain, you know, an assault weapon, guns ban. And
now he was not good on guns. If you're a Second Amendment guy, he wasn't good on guns in California when he was there, and probably because of things like the Black Panthers and the sort of revolutionary factions of the 60s. And he certainly wasn't great as president on guns, though. I don't think there was any real. I'm trying to think. I think in 86, actually, fully automatic weapons were banned, so he was part of that. But I think that's something that most even gun owners agree is okay.
Well, this, I guess, as we come up more to the current moment and whatnot, I'm curious. It seems, going back and reading through your book, a lot of the stuff that a lot of conservative Republicans believed, say, in the mid-80s or even in the early 90s, now they would be considered nuts. Just yesterday, the actress Jamie Lee Curtis she got trolled by somebody at Fox News who said, in the new version of Halloween, her character uses a gun to apparently finally once and for all kill Michael Myers. You know, Lord be, hope we never have to see another Halloween movie. But this guy had pointed out that she's in favor of a bunch of different type of gun control legislation. She came back and said, hey, I fully support the Second Amendment, but I believe in, you know, all of these things that limit, you know, the current understanding of the Second Amendment, like waiting periods, et cetera. Where do we go in a hyper-polarized debate to get some clarity about, like, okay, you know, what we consider the proper reading of the Second Amendment, you know, it seems to be very historically contingent. And at some point, you have people who were in the NRA saying, we want this type of restriction. And now they're saying anybody who wants that kind of restriction is, you know, is a total gun grabber.
I think that Second Amendment advocates have changed their position in the sense that they feel like there's some kind of incremental push to grab guns. So, yeah, you want to ban bump stocks, but if I give you that, I know you're just going to go on to the next thing. And that's probably more like the abortion debate or any other debate we're having. So I think that's what they feel, and I think they have a very good reason to feel that. If you think about, I think it was like 2 years ago, there was a sit-in in Congress where Democrats wanted to pass a bill that banned anyone who was on a secret government terror watch list from owning a gun. I mean, that's an assault on the Second, Fourth, Fifth Amendment. So though, even though I'm not sure they were serious about passing that, but the point is they're not paranoid to think that people want to take their guns. I mean, when you had this after Parkland, you had a CNN show or, you know, I don't know what it was, but people were cheering for banning semi-automatic weapons, which are like the majority of weapons people own. So that's why they're nervous. I think that when I'm talking about the Second Amendment, I care if people. Another reason I called the book First Freedom is because how you view the Second Amendment, I think, says a lot about how you view individual freedom. Now, that's not to say you don't want to ban automatic weapons or have some sort of safety regulations, things like that. But if you believe that a person should have to go to the state to ask to protect their family, their property, themselves, then you don't really believe in individual rights. That is the key individual right. You don't have Republican government without that sort of ideology or philosophy. So what, all I can say is I guess you'd have to take each law separately and see what they're about.
Well, and now, and just to go to, let's finish up by looking at one of these odd paradoxes where you, at various points in American history, there was rising fear of guns, even though crime wasn't going up. And now we're in one of these moments since the mid-90s. Violent crime and particularly crime committed by guns has been going down and down, even as more and more guns are in circulation. And we're talking about this. Tell us how we got to a point, though, also where starting in the 90s, really, gun laws, mostly at the state level and then more recently at the federal level, but gun laws were liberalized so that it became easier for more people to buy more guns under more circumstances and carry them wherever they want. What went on there? Because it seemed to be going on right at the point where everybody was flipping out over gun violence.
I think part of it is that conservatives were just winning the debate and winning seats and and able to pass laws. And in the 90s, at least my memory of the 90s, is that you felt that crime was abating. You felt like New York was much better. It had been better than when I was a kid, and there was less crime, and people weren't as scared of guns. Today, people are more scared of guns, even though crime has fallen, and as you mentioned, and there's been a spike in gun ownership, though the level of people who actually own guns is pretty much the same, despite the fact that, like hunting, where most people owned, were hunters who had guns, that has dropped. People don't hunt anymore as much, but yet people own guns for as hobbyists and also as for self-protection. But I think that has a lot to do with other things, how we live. We live every tragedy in real time together on social media. We panic over everything. There used to be, you know, a single story a day, maybe in a news cycle or maybe once every week. And now there's five every day. And we experience all these things together and we see them in real time. I think that scares people. I have kids in a school. I'm scared for them, even though I know school shootings are less than they used to be. So I think that has more to do with it. And as I've written in another book, you know, voters aren't rational. I mean, they believe all kinds of things that aren't true. It depends who's pushing the narrative, I guess, you know.
How do you think position towards guns? This is also something when you have somebody like Donald Trump running leading the country and leading the Republican Party. He had been a kind of liberal Democrat from New York who did not seem to be particularly libertarian in his Second Amendment thoughts beforehand. Is he a reliable ally of broad Second Amendment rights, or is he a flip-floppy guy? And do you see the Republicans, I guess, here's one of the questions is, just in the past couple of years, we've seen the Republicans reject free trade. We've seen the Republicans move completely away from immigration. the idea of having immigrants come here, et cetera. I mean, is it possible that Trump could lead them if suddenly he wakes up and says, we got to get rid of these guns. This is nuts.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if he did that. I don't think he has any sort of consistent ideology, certainly not on guns. I think he's done a great thing for guns with his Supreme Court justices who are probably uphold Heller and McDonald and things like that. And I don't know that guns are the sort of thing that he would flip on, meaning I don't know that his supporters would flip on it simply because the things you just mentioned, like free trade and immigration, are sort of populist, sort of pseudo-patriotic positions about America that probably aren't fully thought through, but still make some sense together. Whereas guns, I don't really see that changing among the Americans who are his fans, at least. And I think he does what his fans want him to do.
Do you find is the representation of the gun kind of, in a broad sense, in a way? I mean, the book, one of the real, I think, highlights of it is like it's the subtitle, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun. Is the gun still mostly a positive figure in our popular culture? And, this becomes fascinating when you start to think about race and iconography in the same way that Reagan was probably scared by if it had been the White Panthers, he might not have been so worried about the Black Panthers. But you see in a lot of rap and hip hop, there's still a romance of the gun, which used to be the province of, kind of doughy, white actors from Hollywood. Is the gun still an enduring emblem of what it means to be America, or a gesture towards individualism and self-reliance and things like that, or is it more contested now?
I think it's more contested. I don't even think anyone would have entertained any sort of gun control before the 30s. Certainly in the 70s it changed, but now you have sort of a third generation of people who don't understand the history of gun or care for guns or want guns in their neighborhood. So, I think that the views of the public are far more complicated than polls bear out. So you ask someone, you pro-gun, anti-gun, and you give some dumb answer. But I think that a lot of people in America, even liberals, still, I was in Colorado for many years and many liberals there had guns. I think they're more libertarian about that sort of thing, for lack of a better word, than people in New York or East Coast urban places. So I think, yes, I think it's going to be become more partisan. I don't think it's the same as it was, but there are still 400 million or something like that guns mm-hmm. out in America, and those don't go away. And there is still some tradition, and it's a continuum, So if you take a narrow view of history and just for a few years, it looks bad. But I think when you look at a broader look, you never know what's going to happen in 10 years. I think people hopefully will still be a big part of American culture, though not certainly not the same as it was in the 19th century.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will leave it there. We've been talking with David Harsanyi. He's a senior editor at The Federalist, the syndicated columnist, and the author of the excellent and engrossing new book, First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun. David, thanks for talking.
Thanks for having me.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, at Reason.com, and rate and review us wherever you find us. Thanks for listening.